from the insightful studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another discerningly discourseful hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, but I am digging it out of here so that my peerless producer, James Ziprot, and my awesome assistant, the incredible ninja, Sean, will take over and air our favorite interviews from the previous year. Should be tons of fun. So stay tuned. It's all coming up right after this.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the brightly lit studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another herbivorous hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we feature a story that combines solar power, well, with sheep, which we are naturally calling the satisfying saga of solar sheep. Or as the less alliterative newspaper headline puts it, thousands of hungry sheep put to work on solar farms. Dateline, Buchholz, Texas. A recent Associated Press article by Nadia Lathan brings up a, quote, problem that had not yet occurred to me. How do you prevent grasses and weeds from growing in the vast solar groves that help keep our lights on? Longtime listeners might correctly guess the answer to be goats, as modern goat herds have proven to be highly effective at clearing areas of invasive weeds, especially in areas that humans can't easily access. Goats can and will go anywhere, and they can and will eat virtually anything, which is why they are deployed inside fencing to prevent them eating wanted plants and climbing up on people's porch roofs. As the AP article puts it, how do they manage all the grass that grows in these large fields of solar panels? The answer, with the help of thousands of sheep that are better suited than lawnmowers to fit between small spaces, and they chew away rain or shine. The proliferation of sheep on solar farms is part of a broader trend called solar grazing that has exploded alongside the solar industry, with more than 60 grazing projects in the U.S. alone, reports the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The industry has traditionally relied on gas-powered mowers, explains energy asset manager James Hawkins, which kind of contradicts the purpose of being renewable. Putting the sheep to work on the flat and sunny grazing areas that support solar panel use also greatly aids farmers in the sheep and wool market, who have suffered declines in their business in recent years as land for the sheep to graze on has become scarcer and more expensive to use. But my favorite part of this article is that it actually names the farmer who may have started it all. J.R. Howard, who, quote, accidentally found himself in the middle of Texas's burgeoning clean energy transition in 2021 when he began contracting with solar farms encompassing hundreds of thousands of panels to use his sheep to eat their grass. What was once a small business has turned into a full-scale operation named Texas Solar Sheep, with more than 8,000 happy grass munchers and 26 employees. Reed Redden, a fellow sheep farmer and, quote, solar vegetation manager, confirms that a successful sheep business requires grazing land that has become scarce, adding that solar grazing is probably the biggest opportunity for the United States sheep industry in generations, not to mention all those thousands of gas-powered mowers no longer in use. Solar grazing appears to be a triple win.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome to the 2025 Best of Interviews episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the newest year at the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I'm Mike's newly resolute assistant, Sean, and once again, producer James and I are leading the new year with our favorite interviews of the year. Your regularly scheduled program will return next week. For now, get comfortable, don't forget your New Year's resolution, and enjoy this look back at 2025.
We have an amazing interview with the co-author of a brand new book called Saving Orchids. Before I bring him on, I'll tell you about him. His name is Lawrence Zettler, and he is a professor of biology at Illinois College and a research associate at the Chicago Botanic Garden. He has authored or co-authored over 50 peer-reviewed scientific publications and illustrated two books in color involving insects. Can I just call you Lawrence?
Sure. A lot of people call me Larry, but take your pick. I'll answer to both.
I like Larry. I am enthralled by your book. I was taken in completely as I began reading the introductory material and the first chapter. So the first thing I want to talk about is the first thing that you two have placed in the book, which is the story of the, quote, ghost orchid.
Phil would remind me to tell you that in the UK, in England, there's a ghost orchid there as well. So the word ghost orchid, it's not the same species that we have here in the U.S., but it's a common name. And the word ghost usually refers to the fact that they grow in deep shade, both of these two ghost orchids. And because of that, the flowers being white, when you have a gentle breeze, you'll sometimes see this white ghostly-like flower cluster moving around a little bit. So I think the name ghost comes from the fact that it grows in kind of spooky habitats, dark habitats. And in Florida, it would be the swamps. And these flowers are quite amazing once you see this thing in person, how it just kind of hovers in midair, these flowers that are white. And if you get close enough, and if it's closer to nightfall, they produce a sweet-smelling fragrance that really captures you in a unique way.
So that would lead me to believe that they're pollinated by moths.
That's generally the pattern that we see worldwide, is that with orchids, especially orchids with a long, we call this a nectar spur, it's basically like a little place where the butterflies and moths especially can sip nectar. Moths generally have a long tongue-like structure, and when they fly up to a flower like the ghost orchid, it uncurls itself into a tube that they then can sip nectar from. But it happens very quickly, and the blink of an eye, they take a sip, and off they go to the next one.
And the beginning of the book and the story of the ghost orchid all take place in one of the last wild places in Florida that has been heavily researched by a gentleman named Clyde Butcher.
Yep, Clyde Butcher, yep.
Yeah, he seems to have done some amazing work. And in many parts of the book, you are retelling stories of orchid explorers and historians, you know, people who are devoted to the most amazing group of flowers on the planet.
Correct. We're very, very fortunate and happy that Clyde, who was an incredible photographer, has captured the essence of the natural world in Florida and all over. But his black and white photographs from the South Florida swamps, we thought was a fitting way to begin chapter one, because he provides the lens or the eye into the past from his unique perspective on what once was. And his photographs, when you open the book into the first page, there he is in the swamp, and the ghost orchid grows literally right around where he was standing in that image.
And as you warn many times in the book, these areas are a small fraction of the natural world that existed in these places not that long ago, maybe 100 years?
Yeah. Depends on where you go, of course. But what this book has, I think, the message that we have captured in it is that, you know, orchid collectors go back beyond 100 years. And to this day, we still have natural areas. If you know where to look, they're not as extensive as they used to be, but they're around. And unfortunately, the speed of the changes we're seeing in our environment now, we're not so sure that they can keep up with the speed of the changes, but many orchids are adapting as we speak. I think they're going to be around for a long time. We'll always have a lot of orchids that will be with us, but we want to keep as many around as we can. That's the message we want to send.
But preservation of natural areas, especially areas like the Florida Everglades that are damp, still have a lot of trees around, provide a lot of shade. Every inch of these really needs to be protected because we've lost so much.
Well, there's another important message here that I don't think maybe we should have said enough. The ghost orchid is a symbol of plants and the ecosystems down in South Florida, where a lot of the fresh water is at, that the cities in the surrounding region. It's important that we keep natural areas as, you know, intact as possible, and that we have clean drinking water and so on. So the ghost orchid is a symbol of all the incredible, unique life forms in that part of the world and how important it is to keep nature around, not just to enjoy them, not just because some of us like orchids, but we have to protect our drinking water, and especially in populated areas down there. And so it's important that we keep that in mind.
If I remember correctly, the fact that you guys tried to grow these outside of their native environment and over time learned that there was the equivalent of a mycorrhizae that was necessary for these plants that cultivated the bark of the trees they were hanging on.
Yeah, so, pretty much whenever you see an orchid in nature, the reason it's there is it germinated from a seed that was dust-like. You can barely see them with your naked eye. And in that tiny seed are clumps of cells that are basically starving for something to eat. And a fungus, by chance, if it happens to be close by, that seed that lands from the air, if it's the right fungus, then it enters the seed and begins to feed the embryo, and the embryo then begins to grow leaves. So pretty much the fungus that started its life might or might not be there. That's one of the problems, is if the fungus is no longer there, then the life cycle will abruptly end if that orchid needs that one fungus.
So it was really enlightening, especially to me, the aspect that everything depends on everything else in its environment to replicate it. You mention orchids, I believe 30,000 named varieties.
We think about 30,000 species in the world. The number keeps going up because we have specialists that travel to areas that are biologically rich. And we get to, sometimes you find a new species that doesn't match anything that's been described. So the number is going up. But that number is a finite number. We have to keep our natural areas intact so that we can continue to do this.
And you say at one point in the book, orchids are worth saving simply for their beauty. I mean, there's no ugly orchid out there, right? Uh-oh.
You put me on the spot. Well, I don't think ugly is a good word. I cherish and I appreciate all orchids, no matter how vibrant they look to the eye. Smell is a big deal. I like to smell orchids a lot when I'm at Orchid Society shows. That to me, the fragrance of some of these is unbelievably good. Occasionally, you'll hit an orchid that wants to be pollinated by, say, carrion flies, and you don't want to put your nose too close to that.
Right, because their odor is rotting meat to attract flies. That's not unique to orchids. That happens in the plant world, including with the Native American fruit pawpaw.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I enjoy watching the little flies in the springtime.
But I will close with the fact that after you talk about preserving them for their sheer beauty, the way we preserve wonderful works of art, there are untold medicines and compounds, many of which we already use in medicine that originally came from plants, that need to be investigated in orchids.
Yeah, well, we actually have some new studies being done right as we speak on that, and orchids do have some chemicals that are of interest to us. Yeah, so we're always looking for new chemicals, antibiotics, and everything. So, in fact, the medicine chest that you have available to us in pharmacies, the number I keep hearing is a quarter of all your medicines over the counter, et cetera, originated from the plant kingdom. The number goes to 50% if you include fungi, such as penicillium, that gave us penicillin.
Yeah. Again, anybody who thinks they know a lot about orchids will have their brain turned around by the book. And, of course, there's plenty of pretty pictures. So we recommend it highly. It's called Saving Orchids. And we've been speaking to one of the authors, Lawrence Zettler. Thank you so much for being with us on You Bet Your Garden.
Well, it's my pleasure. And thank you for the nice, kind words.
Well, it's time for us to take a little break and remind you that today's show has been hijacked by Mike's peerless producer, James, and awesome assistant, Sean. Don't worry, though. We have him set up in front of a TV with all the candy he could ask for. But don't go calling the rescue team just yet, because we'll be right back with more of our favorite interviews of 2025 and an always interesting question of the week. You're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. WDIY News engages the local community through accurate, unbiased reporting from many sources with volunteer real voices. Listen to WDIY News weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. and 4 to 6 p.m. and weekends from 8 to 10 a.m. WDIY News, available live on 88.1 FM and online at WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the newest of the new You Bet Your Garden, where we are continuing our search for the golden nuggets of 2025, not the squash. We've got the best interviews we could dig up from the You Bet Your Garden raised beds.
Now it's time for us to tackle Thor Hansen, who has been on the guest several times before as the author of Buzz and The Triumph of Seeds. He's a conservation biologist, Guggenheim Fellow. He does wonderful work that, in my mind, simply involves walking around his writing shed, making some notes, and then writing another book. Thor, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Mike.
So how accurate was that?
Well, there is a bit of walking around, for sure. And your mention of the writing shed, perfect for the latest effort that I have, because this is a book that's all about the biology of backyards and neighborhood parks and things, well, as the title of the book says, close to home.
I can't believe you reclaimed a shed from raccoons. I would have burned it to the ground and built something, man.
Yeah, that's what we call the shed. It's my writing house, and it's the little raccoon shack out there. Named for the previous owners, we had to evict them to move me in. But it's a pretty simple but effective little structure in which to think and to write.
And Buzz was kind of like a prelude to this book, because it is your observations when, if I remember correctly, you didn't exactly go out to observe anything.
Yeah, so the book Buzz was all about native bees, really focusing, even though we have these marvelous honeybees that are domestic species, but it tends to overlook the wonders of the native bees in our landscape, which are incredibly diverse. There's a famous line that people use about the people coming from Europe, the settlers bringing honeybees with them, which is true. But I heard an historian say once that if they hadn't, there wouldn't have been anything here to pollinate their crops, which is absolute. That's so off, because we have 4,000 species of native bees buzzing around North America. So I wanted to shine the spotlight on them in the book Buzz. And they also play a role here and there in this backyard biology book, because they really are everywhere once you stop and slow down and look.
That really seems to be your forte, finding a bee and following it for miles to see what else it does.
Yeah, I often tease people when we go for nature walks, because we say we're, you know, bird watching or what have you, but it tends to boil down to bird identification. People will look at something, a bird or a plant or something, just long enough to identify it, and then drop the binoculars and move on to the next one. And I try to stress in my own life, as well as on nature walks and to other people, that if we can focus on the watching, if we can remember to put the watching in, that's when we really learn about behavior and interactions and ecology and biology and all the wonderful things that are happening. Not just who's doing it, but what they're doing.
And you recycling this horrifying old shack into your writing habitat, probably left behind endless habitats, right?
Yeah, well, the shack itself is habitat for more than just one biologist author. On the outside of it, the siding there is old cedar that is sort of peeling back from the edges of the shack. And I was out there once thinking, you know, I really ought to tack that down again. And I started to do it, and out flew a bat. So I've left the peeling side of that, because the bats are in there in droves, and I don't want to disturb them. So I have neighbors right outside my window.
Yeah, and you have an excuse not to do things, which is one of my premium goals in life. Oh, I shouldn't disturb that. Something may be living there.
You know, that's a really good point, and it really is true in a variety of situations when you're talking about managing your yard for biodiversity, in that it's one of the few things where doing less provides more benefit. in that if you leave more old berry canes lying around, you'll get more of those bees and other insects that nest in them. If you leave some of the leaves scattered around underneath your shrubs, you leave a nice mulch down there of leaf litter and twigs and so forth. You'll have bumblebees overwintering there, the queen bumblebees. You'll have all sorts of insects and other creatures that live in that mulch. So a cluttered yard, one where you've spent less time cleaning up, is actually going to provide you with a lot more diversity of life.
We had a very spirited discussion over the winter because one of my main goals is to get people to build raised beds, grow some of their own food, and make compost with which to fill those beds and nurture the food. And as you may know, you can't make compost with garbage alone. You need large amounts of dry brown material. So for decades, I have been proselytizing, you know, get a leaf blower with the reverse setting, suck up your leaves and use them as the dry brown material in your compost piles. And we started to get some pushback from lightning bug lovers here on the East Coast, because apparently the Pennsylvania firefly nests over the winter in leaf litter.
Yes. Yes, so that's a great example where the less is more concept, in that you're going to have those fireflies in your yard if you leave the habitat for them. So you might have to look for a different source of dry matter, or at least leave some of it. That's another option for folks too. And sort of a double management goal there is have some compost, but also have some fireflies to enjoy.
That's exactly what we settled on. Now, in your author's note, the introduction to the book, you mentioned something. I didn't have time to get to it, but I had to underline the phrase stargazing dung beetles. Only you, man.
Yeah, well, this is a fascinating story. Some research done out of the southern part of Africa, and they'd noticed that, as you have noticed, the lightning bugs declining in your neighborhoods. Well, people there noticed that the dung beetles, which are a very prolific and common creature in that habitat, really declining anywhere that people settle. In towns and suburbs and cities, the dung beetles just drop right off. And it took people a long time to figure out why. Not just the loss of habitat, that's some of it, but even when you had some good open space and, you know, dung lying around, you had far fewer beetles. And one of the reasons turns out to be a source of pollution that all of us have control over. And I really like this example because it is one of the rare environmental problems that you can solve with a flick of the switch. And what it is light pollution. The dung beetles navigate, it turns out, by gazing up with their little faceted dung beetle eyes into the night sky, and they navigate using the pale streak of the Milky Way, which is one of the first things in the night sky that disappears when you start to have perpetual light pollution from human settlements. And so as people settled in these areas and built houses, put up streetlights and so on, the light pollution at night obscures that Milky Way, and the dung beetles can't get from point A to point B, and it contributes to this steep decline. And it's a great thing to keep in mind whenever you see a moth circling your porch light or landing on your bright window at night, or if you see, you know, other insects that are falling for that trap of being attracted to lights, it is something that you can do something about. Because when you see that, it's not just a chance to view them. You have to keep in mind you're seeing creatures doing something that they shouldn't be doing. They are confused. They are disoriented by that brightness. And they're losing valuable time, because many of those creatures have only a few days as adults, as flying adults, with which to look for a mate and reproduce and have the next generation of moths and so forth. And so if they spend those nights on your window, they're not going to reproduce, and you're going to see a decline in that species in your neighborhood. So it's one of the things we can control by turning off the light or by shading lights so they point only downward and attract fewer insects at night, or by simply pulling the window shade down at night in your living room so that the light is not broadcasting out into your yard. And when you do those simple things, you can see an immediate impact on the insects. Turn off the light for a minute or two, they fly off to a more suitable darkness to continue their lives, and you can turn your lights back on and go back to your reading or card game or whatever was entertaining you at night.
It occurs to me, and it hadn't before, I talk about light pollution a lot. And again, getting back to fireflies / lightning bugs, light pollution is felt to be one of their biggest enemies. But I just made the connection in my neural synapses that out in the woods, out in the open, without humans, without Edison, there are no sources of artificial light, and these creatures really do go about their business the way God intended.
It's remarkable. You know, when you boil it down to just what you've observed there, artificial light is like nothing in nature. So these species, when they see that bright porch light, whatever it may be, they're encountering something not only that they've never encountered in their short lives, they're encountering something that their species has never encountered over the millions of years of its evolution. It's totally bewildering and blinding. And that is why it can be so destructive to insect populations over time. I mean, one thing that leapt out at me from the research I've done for this recent book is how being in nature is not only an uplift to your day, but it's physically good for you. There are now measurable ways that scientists can see the benefits of simply spending time outdoors or even just seeing nature through glass. One of my favorite studies ever, favorite scientific papers in history, is a wonderful little two-page paper from Science Magazine back in 1984. And it's a study that took place at a small hospital in Pennsylvania, if memory serves, somewhere back there in your general neck of the woods. And these doctors and medical researchers looked at 10 years of data of people recovering from the very same gallbladder surgery in the very same ward of the hospital, where the only difference between their treatment and between their recovery was the view from their window. One of the rooms had a view out at a grove of trees, and the other had a view across the courtyard at a brick wall. And when they looked at that data and controlled for all the variables that scientists control for, so they were just comparing the view, they learned that the people who were looking at trees got out of the hospital sooner, they required fewer painkillers, they called the nurse's station less often, and they suffered fewer complications from their surgery. And that is all attributable to simply looking out and seeing the soothing effect of these trees. That's not even being outside under the trees, which provides even more benefits. So it's now possible to get a medical prescription for nature exposure as part of your treatment in, I believe now, 35 states, because it is medically recognized.
Are you serious?
Being outdoors. I am dead serious. Yeah, it lowers anxiety. It helps with blood pressure. It lowers rates of diabetes.
I mean,
we've
always said that about you can lower your blood pressure just by going for a walk in the forest. But the fact that medicine would catch on to that is wonderful and amazing.
Isn't that, it's remarkable. You know, that little paper was a step in this direction, and it has become sort of a runaway bestseller, if you will, in scientific circles. It's been cited by over 8,000 other studies that have expanded and built upon those findings, that in fact, nature does things for us that science can measure.
I had a tough winter. I got pneumonia, and I had to spend 8 days in the hospital. And I think one of the reasons I got out as quickly as I did, my room had this giant picture window that looked out into a neighborhood, but I was high up. Mostly I just saw roofs and trees. I felt so much better.
Right. Isn't that something? Yeah. And it's, you know, we've always known or told one another that, you know, if you need to let off a little steam or feel better, you know, get outside and clear your mind. Well, it's medical. You are clearing your mind. You are helping your body in ways you can't even imagine.
Now, we have diverted greatly from your book, which includes you observing monarchs talking about how streptomycin was isolated from a compost pile. And apparently you had an ongoing battle with an owl. And, you know, no offense, Thor, but my money's on the owl.
Yeah, no kidding. You've never felt more like a mouse than being attacked by that owl. Holy moly. We had a young owl, a barred owl, a juvenile, that decided that our yard was its territory. And for several weeks one summer, we honestly took to wearing bike helmets outdoors because we were being dive bombed. Or umbrellas or what have we, all sorts of defenses against this young owl because it was having none of us in its territory. But it was a fascinating reminder that even though you might be paying the rent or the mortgage or what have you on the place that you're living, there are very likely a lot of other creatures that consider that place their home. Whether it's the yard or, you know, the neighborhood park, you know, these are places that other creatures live, and they don't see you as the owner or the manager of that place. In many cases, they see you as an interloper. And I think it's particularly true for nocturnal creatures because the backyards and neighborhoods of human establishments are mostly vacant as soon as the sun goes down. And so that's when a lot of other animals become active and take over management of those spaces.
Well, the book is Close to Home by Thor Hansson, Hanson. Thor, it is always a great pleasure to have you on the show. I wish you the best of luck with the book and keep on observing.
Thanks, Mike. You too, and thanks for having me on. It's always a really fun discussion.
Well, I think we'll take another break now, but don't go anywhere because Mike has handed us, his producer James and assistant Sean, the reins for a look back on 2025's best interviews. We'll be right back with more You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA.
What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Welcome back once again to the Best of Interviews episode of You Bet Your Garden. We are approaching the end of our Best of Duo of episodes. We hope you enjoyed these special retrospectives of You Bet Your Garden 2025 in review.
It is now time to welcome our special guest, Rick Bickling from the Square Foot Gardening Foundation and contributing editor to the new book. We are going to speak about the all new Square Foot Gardening 4th edition. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Mike.
Well, thank you for being here. A lot of changes from the previous editions.
Yes, we really tried to update it a lot more. We've got 200 new photos, 30 new illustrations. Tried to make it a little bit more applicable and easy to read for the gardener today.
Most people, when they think of square foot gardening, think of the layout, the design, the squares. But Mel was insistent from day one that it was about, quote, Mel's mix, the soil combination that helps your square foot gardening grow to its utmost.
That's correct. It's there's three main pillars to square foot gardening. The first is, rather than filling up a big area of the yard and planting a row garden, you use a raised bed. There's a lot of people that have raised beds, and they might dig up some dirt in the yard and toss it in there, but you really don't know what you're going to get when you do that. I mean, there's...
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You're going to get poor results. Come on.
So Mel's mix, if you want me to
talk
about that a little bit, it's basically three natural organic components in three equal parts by volume: compost, peat moss, and vermiculite.
Mike's mix is one-third finished compost, one-third screened high-quality topsoil, and one-third perlite.
Yeah.
We're looking at the same thing. That's what I like. Now, I want to talk about the progression to better raised beds in this edition of the book. You do a fabulous job of showing people how to build really high-quality raised beds.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, the trick is you've got to decide what you're going to build your bed with. Some of the criteria that you might want to use in determining what you're going to use, whether it's wood or concrete block or bricks or steel, we can buy a steel bed. How much does it cost? How long is it going to last? If you're building it yourself, how easy will it be to build? Is it safe? For example, we really strongly recommend you don't use railroad ties.
And oh, my God.
Creosote and chromated copper arsenate are probably not two things you want to be picking with your carrots. So they got to be safe. And really, pressure-treated wood supposedly doesn't use a lot of the chemicals you used to, but I am still kind of leery of it.
Yeah, I don't want it. But would you say the heart and soul of the book is the sacred square foot gardening grid?
Well, first let's talk about what the grid is. The grid is a 1 foot by 1 foot grid that you put on top of your bed, whatever size it is. So basically, instead of having a row of carrots, a row of green beans, you work 1 square foot grid at a time, and you'll plant something in one grid and something in another. Now, the spacing of the vegetables is still what it always is. You know, everyone knows when they get a pack of carrots, you look at it and it says plant these 3 inches apart, or tomatoes 1 to 2 feet apart. You're still using that same spacing, but instead of having a big line, you put it in a square. So, for example, carrots, plant them 3 inches apart, and it used to be you'd fill up a big garden, hoe maybe a 4 foot row, put a bunch of carrot seeds in there, and as they grow, you'd thin them out to be about 3 inches apart. And then 3 feet down from that row, you'd put another row in to grow something else. That way you could kind of walk in there in between. So that's 12 square feet and you're growing 16 carrots. Now with square foot gardening, if you take 1 square foot and you just plant 16 carrot seeds in there, 3 inches apart, you kind of just like a little checkerboard pattern, you can actually get 16 carrots in 1 square foot. So that's, you know, 12 square feet versus 1 square foot to get 16 carrots. That's a good example.
And I can guarantee that those carrots are going to be longer, straighter, and maybe even sweeter by not being overcrowded.
Well, square foot gardening lets you grow more food in less space with less waste. And it does that by using 80% less space than a traditional row garden. You can use 90% less water, a lot fewer seeds. We figure about 98% less work and half the cost.
All right. We have been talking with Rick Bickling, advisor to the board of directors of the Square Foot Foundation. So again, Rick, thank you. I recommend people go out and check out the Square Foot Gardening 4th edition. All right, thanks for being with us, man.
Thanks a lot.
As always, it is indeed time for the question of the week, which we are calling, Is This Your Summer? for backyard chickens. Cases of bird flu are on a rampant rise. News reports have the price of a dozen ordinary eggs skyrocketing, as over 145 million birds have already had to be killed when the highly pathogenic virus was found in their flocks. And as many of us know, higher quality eggs that are certified organic or, quote, pasture raised cost even more because it costs a lot more to produce them. Which leads me to wonder, is this the year that many cost and health conscious on the fencers make the move to backyard chickens? I bring this up because now is the time to prepare coops to raise baby birds into egg layers, as those baby chicks are only available in the early spring. And then I read an article by Corin Miller that appeared in Food and Wine magazine entitled, "Yes, the Color of Your Egg Yolk Matters." It contains some great information that may sway your decision of whether or not to play chicken, and more importantly, how you would then feed and raise your birds. If you wish to read the entire article, I'll provide a link in the written version of this question of the week at the Gardens Alive /Gurney's website under Garden Resources. The article begins, "We asked poultry experts to explain what's behind the shade of egg yolks. Richard Blaxford, PhD, a poultry researcher, explains that grocery store eggs usually have a bright yellow or pale orange yolk, but there are variations within these colors. Poultry experts and farmers keep track of yolk color," he explains. "The DSM yolk color fan is a 16-scale color index that distinguishes yolk color and is widely used in the poultry industry. Under the scale, each number corresponds with a different shade. Number 1, for example, is pale yellow, while 16 is a deep shade of orange. People really tend to like the rich, dark-colored yolks," adds Blatchford. "There are a lot of factors that can influence egg yolk color, and most of it comes down to the diet," says Sunyo Che, DVM, PhD, associate professor of poultry management at the University of Maryland. "The biggest factors include the amount of corn in the feed. Corn can influence how yellow a yolk is," says Blatchford. "Hens that lay grocery store eggs are usually fed a corn-based diet. That's why most grocery store eggs are a yellow color, but not really bright. The other is access to fresh pasture. Hens with access to fresh grass and pasture tend to produce eggs with more vibrant yolk colors," says Che. "That's because these hens generally have a more varied diet with sources of protein from bugs and nutrients known as carotenoids." Jen Hoskins, PhD, RD, Director of Nutrition Research at the American Egg Board's Egg Nutrition Center, agrees. "A deeper orange color may reflect a diet that includes foraging, where hens can access different plants and insects whose pigments can impact the color. Yolk color doesn't necessarily indicate that the egg is more nutritious," adds Shea, "but pasture-raised hens often produce eggs with higher levels of nutrients like omega-3 fatty acids and vitamins due to their diverse diet, not necessarily the intensity of the yolk color. That said, yolk color can indicate the level of carotenoids in the egg, says Hotchkins. Carotenoids are linked with good eye health, along with a lower risk of cancer, diabetes, and inflammation. Generally, says Hotchkins, deeper orange yolks suggest a higher level of those carotenoids. And finally, do orange egg yolks taste better? The answer appears to be a resounding yes. The best tasting eggs come from happy hens that get to forage free range on grass, bugs, and vegetable scraps, says Food and Wine senior food editor Brianna Killeen, who raises egg-laying hens at her farm in Shelbourne, Vermont. Chicken feed can create yolks with an orange color, but the flavor doesn't compare to yolks from chickens that are actually foraging. McGrath here for some final words. I do not want to oversimplify the responsibilities that come with raising chickens. The babies have to be kept warm, and birds of all ages need a safe, critter-proof coop in which to spend the night, protected from foxes and other predators. By day, they also need protection from above, as hawks and other raptors are a serious threat, although less so if you have a rooster or two around. I once watched a rooster chase off a red-tailed hawk that had plunged right through a fabric outdoor covering, and the hawk got the worst of it. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention Elliot Coleman's inventive chicken tractor, a large metal cage open only on the bottom that you can use to constantly move the birds to fresh pasture. If you are now motivated, read your state's extension bulletins on this topic. There are also a number of good books and other resources available. Oh, and one last thought. Don't do anything to attract wild birds to this area. No feeders, no roosts, no birdhouses, no bird baths. These wild birds could infect your flock with the flu. Well, that sure was some great advice about backyard chickens, now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to corral my chickens if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. And what are we going to do for eggs? But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, and you can find your own darn eggs. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming, to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Please tell us where you live. Go next door. Ask somebody. Do you have a utility bill? When you meet people at a party and they say, where are you from? Do you just stare blankly? Or do you actually have an idea? If you do, please share it with us. You'll find that new phone number, that new email address, a link to the ever-growing Gardens Alive archive of previous answers, and new and improved links to our podcast site, all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he was traumatized by the sight of a drunk beating up Mr. Peanut on the Atlantic City boardwalk. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the legendary, awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your sort of host, Mike McGrath, and I'd like to thank once again our peerless producer, James Ziproth, and the awesome Ninja Sean for putting together the interviews we enjoyed today. I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I'm going into the witness protection program. I'll be working at a McDonald's somewhere in San Diego or Florida, but not here. But they'll drag me back to see you again next week.